Thanks, Dan. I think I better quit while I'm ahead. So I'm Bob Gobiel. Your program says that this is a talk about some data mining tools that HP uses, and we'll get into that too. First thing is, everybody here I'm sure knows who Fossology is, and the pronunciation would be up there if I use the right character set, but I just want to make sure everybody understand what this is about. It's just about studying FOSS. Just like you do any other kind of data mining activity, we're specifically looking at open source software. I'm a fossologist, and of course this word, because the word bothers some people, but it is from the ancient Greek, so don't let that bother you. Fossology is a pretty simple system. You know, if you're going to study software, you've got to get the software, you got to put it someplace, you got to run programs that learn something about the software. You know, you got to look at the software and figure out what it is you can figure out. Then you got to store the data someplace. So that's pretty much the system, and I'll get back to this so you don't have to worry about it too much. But I'll talk about that in a little bit. You know, so you got a web GUI that can, or a command line to get things into a software repository. You've got agents that look at this. You've got agents that look at the repository. Remember, your software is just a data file to these analysis agents. Stick the results back into a database, and we've got a scheduler to run those analyses in the background. And I'll touch on why we even wrote our own scheduler, because that's probably the first thing some people would ask is, why the heck we write a scheduler? But I'll get to that. So one thing when I start talking about this is, for some people, they don't understand why we would want to study software. What the heck can you learn about software? So this is where it started. The Second Mycenaean War, 640 BC, Mycenaeans led by Aristomenes revolted against the Spartans. Does everybody know this? Because if they do, I won't go over it. Okay, so we'll just do this. According to some sources, the Athenian opponent by the name of Tartarus was sent to Sparta and subduing the Mycenaeans. The Mycenaeans were defeated. This is the important part of this whole thing. This is why I'm reading it. They were defeated in 631 BC in the Battle of the Great Foss. So this is something that you should all know, because everybody here is interested in free and open source software. I think this is where it started. But the real question is, you know, why did they have the battle in the first place? You know, what was the deal here? And I think the battle came about because there was so much FUD concerning FOSS that, you know, people were making up stuff, and then, you know, it gets very religious and they all, you know, bang on each other. So it's really important to have objective tools where you can to learn what you can about FOSS. What does this have to do with the Distro Summit? That's why we're here, right? Okay, but first, I want to talk about why Hewlett-Packard created Fossology. That picture is a little hard to see. I would even get closer if it wasn't for the feedback. But that's a penguin scratching its itch. In fact, I know you're wondering, it's a Gen 2 penguin, so, you know, it actually is. But this is why Hewlett-Packard started studying software. Trying to answer a few questions, and I'll talk about all these in a minute, but, you know, to unambiguously reference files, you hear this question in a lot of different ways it's broached, you know. I'll talk about it in a minute. Uncover legal obligations. This is a big thing for HP since we distribute software. And so we are encumbered by the laws governing the distribution of that software. Consolidate FOSS metadata. Well, you know, you're always learning stuff about software. Well, where do you put it? You know, where do you put the results? Do you distribute it across all the projects? Do you distribute it across all the distros? Do you make some new thing? Code originality. So for Hewlett-Packard, and by the way, I'm using Hewlett-Packard as an example because this is where, you know, we started this stuff, but I believe that these issues affect pretty much many, many people and companies. Code originality. If we contract with somebody to write some code and it comes back to us and AHP believes they own that code, that was original code, is it? and project interdependencies. What does that mean? Anybody know? I'll talk about it in a minute. And then by that time, I'll have remembered. So unambiguously referencing files. So, you know, people think that if you refer to a particular version of a particular file or a particular package, that whatever you have is the same thing that I have. And it isn't true. It might be true, but you don't know. There may be different architectures. There may be different patch levels that don't show up in the version number. So one thing that's really important for us is to be able, when we refer to something, that we know exactly what we're talking about. And I'll clear that up in a little bit. So for example, with the example of the vulnerabilities and license obligations, you may have a particular version of a package. The next version or a slight change in it can change the licensing quite a bit. Different people have tried to solve this ambiguity problem. How many people are familiar with CPE from MITRE Corporation? Well, it's actually an open source project now. Raghavan, you familiar with it? What they're trying to do is create a hierarchical naming scheme to be able to uniquely identify platforms and projects. So you can see that's just taken from their latest spec on the top there, where you've got a part, a vendor, product version, all of this kind of stuff. And there's an example for RHEL 4, Update 4. This is an interesting approach. I think they've actually been working on this for some years. I'm not sure what the status of it is, but I know that they're actively working on the specification. This is what we do in Fossology. Now, everybody understands numbers, so I'm going to take that off, and is everybody going to remember that number? Because we're going to need it again later. So what we want to do when we want to uniquely identify something is we want to create a GUID for it, a global unique identifier. So that's what that is there. Don't ask me what file it's from, because I don't really know. But it's made up of three parts, a SHA-1, the file SHA-1, the file's MD5, and the size of the file. So with that, if you give me a file and you compute those three things and give it to me, I can tell you what that file is. That's all you need to tell me. If I have that file in my Fossology repository, because that's where I have a database that tells me that is file X. Of course, don't forget that you notice this has nothing to do with where this file came from. It has nothing to do with the name of the file. It only has to do with the file contents. Yes, sir.
I have to ask, why do you use two hash algorithms?
Because we're anal. Seriously, I mean, you can come up with examples where you can fool an MD5. Okay, it's been done, right? But because of the way MD5s and SHA-1s work, they kind of work backwards from each other, the idea of having something with the same MD5 and the same SHA-1 is just unbelievably.
That's wrong.
SHA-2 what? Oh. Well, but we were trying to go for different algorithms because we think the probability of collisions is smaller by combining two different algorithms. I don't know that that's true, so I'm not. Is there any advantage? So I'm not familiar with SHA-6.
Well, SHA-256 is just like a bigger
right.
Hash.
Right,
number.
Right.
So in theory, you have a smaller
right.
Okay.
Okay.
The person from the security conference talking about Zion said once that the SHA-1 or the MD5 are the biggest used for the SHA-1 now.
Correct.
A larger hash is the
best.
So is SHA-2. Okay. That's what we do for better or worse. Let me just say one more thing about this. You notice, of course, that it has no name. It has no other metadata about the file. It's only based on contents. All of that other information gets stored in the database, you know, where we have pointers that say, you tried to upload this, or this .gz has this file in this path, and it points to something like that, okay? The reason we do that sort of thing is because we can store files across multiple servers with a GUID and have no replicated files. So our Fossology system, as we load files into our software repository, actually gets faster the more you load into it, because there's so much code reuse in open source. It's everything. So what we do, and thank you, because I realize now that it wasn't very clear, when you load something into the Fossology repository, let's say you load in an ISO, okay? We do that for the ISO, and we save the ISO. Then we unpack the ISO into all of its component pieces, and then we do that for every single piece. So this goes down from the ISO all the way down to the file level, and everything in between. Okay. So legal obligations. A single project can have dozens of different licenses spread across hundreds of files. This is something that drives, you know, enterprises up the wall when they're used to having a single license for whatever it is they buy. A distro has thousands of licenses. So this is, if you use our tools, this is something that you'll see. This is for a single DVD, a source DVD. This is just the first part of the list. The list is kind of long. You can see this is how we report the licenses. We actually break them down into all the different variants. You know, you can see all of these variant FSF, GPL, V2, reference 6, all of that kind of stuff. Because in some applications, you know, you need to know, well, which GPL V2, how is that, you know, that sort of thing. And once you have this level of detail, it's easy to aggregate, if you want to aggregate it. This is the bottom of that list for that single DVD. You can see that we found 143,000 total licenses on that DVD. So those are individual instances of licenses or references to licenses. Okay, that's a lot of licenses. And that 149 license categories is, excuse me, this list here is 149 rows long. And no, I did not make up the WTFPL. And it is probably what you think it might mean. So consolidating metadata. So if you have files someplace and you learn something about files, you got to stick the data someplace. We use a database for that. And so right now, we keep three things in there. Because this project just started. We open sourced this project in November?
December 18th.
So this is a new project. This is based on tools that HP developed about 7 years ago and have been in continual use and evolution since then. But the actual open source project is quite new. So we'll be adding to what you see here. Well, hopefully, maybe some of you will be adding to what we see here. Right now, we do license analysis, like you just saw. And we parse spec files because we wanted to for Fedora. What we were interested in is comparing the stated license in F9 with the actual licenses that we found to look for discrepancies. Fedora also has a policy for what licenses are allowed. And if we wanted to, of course, we could match against those policies. That's something, by Jove, that goes across all distros, isn't it? Or most distros. So we also used libextractor. Anybody here use libextractor? OK, rats. And I can't lie. But were you? Well, we like it because it was a very easy way to get a lot of data. Mostly what we see are data, metadata from audio and video files. But there's a list of all the different file formats that it supports that we can grab and put into our database. Here's, I just queried our database for what are all the known keys from LibExtractor. Now, these are ones that we mine. This isn't, you know, anything magic. When you find something, it gets stuck in a database. And there's a key definition in our database. So here is the list. And if I made any mistakes, I think I'm going to hear about it. Everybody get those? I was going to make up a song to go with that, but it just didn't work. You are so lucky. Okay, code originality. So, you know, as you know, building on the source code of others is encouraged in open source, but is it just cloned for no good reason? Is it, you know, just code bloat? Is the license honored? These are pretty big questions for those of us who want to stay within the law, or and just sort of trying to keep the code clean. So licenses are not always honored. You're probably familiar with Software Freedom Law Center's lawsuits on behalf of BusyBox for GPL violations. Project dependencies. You know, I'm going to sit here and read the slide. If you discover vulnerability in zlibDevel, zlibDevel is used by Audacity, so you know that Audacity may have that same vulnerability. Finding all of those dependencies, and this gets back to a little bit about what you were talking about earlier in the Distro Summit, John, is really powerful. Now, the thing you got to remember here is we're not depending on what the package maintainer said. We're not depending on anybody. We are looking at the code. Oh, one disclaimer, this doesn't exist. This is yet, okay? We are going to do this. There's a lot of different ways to approach this. But it, remember those goals, those things we were trying to solve for HP? This was one of them, and that's why I'm talking about it here. But this is really key, because now, if you identify a problem in a file, I can easily tell you every place that file's used, and in a few minutes, I'm going to tell you that if you can identify, say, a function within a file or a piece of a function in a file, we can find every place it's used. Okay. That's right. That's a really good point. This requires a lot of introspection of the files. This is very CPU intensive, figuring out all this stuff.
Just let me get it right. You're listing zlib because it is actually mostly statically used. There are 100,000 copies of it in the Edge archive, not because you're linking with it, but because it's compiled in.
Right.
Okay. I'm just trying to understand it.
Yeah. Well, actually, in the case of vulnerabilities, it doesn't matter if it's statically linked or not. For licenses, it may matter, but not for vulnerabilities.
Well, we have this major problem, where we have it right now in Debian, for instance, with the XPDF code, which exists like 15 times or something in the archive. Now, if we find a vulnerability in the XPDF code, we have to find out which packages actually use it. Mm-hmm. If instead packages use zlib and link against it, and we find a vulnerability in that library, then all we have to do is upload a new library, and that's it.
From a distribution maintainer, that's true. From a user, it's a little bit different. From a user's perspective, you want to know every package that you use that may have that vulnerability. The fix is the same that you're talking about, right? But you still want to know where your vulnerabilities are, because it may be in packages that you don't care about, that you have them, but you don't really use them for anything that would matter for. It's a small... Okay. Any other questions? So we don't want to depend on the stated project dependencies. Ah, doggone it, I messed up my rhythm. Some people asking questions just... Okay. So, I practiced this once, Martin, and it was really important that, you know, when you're talking about dependencies where you have a dependency graph, that you need to be able to uniquely identify every piece of software on that graph. And that was problem one, uniquely identifying problems. See how that all ties together? Wasn't that cute? Okay. And back to this again. So now you can kind of see how this, well, maybe you can kind of see how this works, where we've got a repository where the software's in. We've got agents that do all that intensive stuff, actually looking at the software, trying to figure out something like dependencies, like licenses, like whatever, and putting that data into the metadata repository. Okay. So as far as interfaces with this stuff, interfaces to Fossology, Fossology isn't a point-and-click project. You can use it that way, but you can't automate anything through point-and-click. Well, you can, but it's a hassle, right? So we have shell programs, or just command line programs, of course, that you can use to get things into the repository, copy to FOSS. Well, guess what that does? Give you a file, copy to FOSS it, and it goes into the repository. Putting things into our repository is actually several steps, because our repository might be distributed across multiple machines. That's why we need that GUID, so that we don't duplicate anything. Copy to FOSS also takes care of all that translation and the naming and stuff like that. Okay, so I'm not going to read that. This is what our GUI looks like for putting something into the repository. That's exciting, isn't it? You can grab something from the web. If you've got a URL, put it in there and hit begin upload, and that's all you have to do. That thing down there, it says request reports with license analysis checked. That's just the default thing we do, since we're big on licenses, and that's where this whole project started. We always do a license analysis. You can turn it off if you want. So the file system repository. So like I mentioned, the files are stored in the file system, not in the database. It's just easier for us to manage. And I talked about the GUID, so that files are only stored once. So I just did this query to find out how many different files have been uploaded from, well, I guess it was Fedora 8. So we've a few Debian Etch DVDs. So there's over 5 million files that we uploaded in this test system that I was fooling around with. Over a million of them, 21%, were duplicate files. Now that's cool, because now I don't have to reanalyze those files. You know, you upload Project A version X, and then you upload Project A version X plus 1, and a whole bunch of those files are the same. You know, maybe it was just a bug fix. So all those files that were the same are already in the repository. We're done with them. We don't even have to reanalyze them. So since the GUID is based on the SHA-1 MD5, that changes the file name. So that will be stored again.
Is there any way to do some data mining and find things where, okay, show me all the files that essentially are the same except for white space and trivial changes? Do you have any plans for something
like that? There's no plans for something like that. If we had a use for it. But we still probably want to keep it. It complicates the problem a lot if we try to optimize that out and say, well, this file is so much percent the same as this file. It complicates it a lot in our system. So we just save them. This space isn't that much.
Well, yeah, I'm more thinking like for a distro maintainer, maybe trying to weed out things that at least don't need to both be in here with slight changes.
Exactly.
Yeah,
absolutely. And the answer is yes, and I'll get to that.
At the risk of disturbing your rhythm. have you looked at Git?
No.
The version control tool, because basically I'm looking at this, and I'm looking at Git, and it pretty much does the same. Now I'm not trying to say like this is useless, because we already have everything else, right? Not at all.
My boss is here. Don't say that. Sorry. Yeah.
No, just in terms of like Git can actually tell you. These two files are 88% identical, and it uses GUIDs to store them, and it doesn't store duplicate files. So and maybe there's something, if you had a use case for.
Well, there is a use case for finding file similarity, and we'll get to that in a minute. We just do it. I don't know how Git does it. Do you? Does anybody know how Git does the similarity part?
It's magic.
Nope. Magic? Oh, we've got the same thing. Okay. Okay, so the database is nothing special. We just use Postgres, and we have things in it to just make this easy to grow. That slide doesn't say a lot, does it? Okay, these are the current agents we have. You can see they do fairly specific things. You know, we have an agent to, I'm going to back up here. I described agents as what does the analysis. Actually, that's wrong. What agents really do is do anything we want in the background. Okay? So we have agents that download something from the internet. We call it the WGET agent. How do you like that name? We have files. We have an agent that extracts files from containers, whether the container is an ISO, a TAR-GZ, or whatever, that just grabs all the files out of that container recursively. We call it the ununpack agent. But we have agents, we have analyzed files for licenses. Do you know what we call that? The license agent. Okay. We have an agent that'll run shell scripts, because sometimes if you want to do something, it's easy just to write a little shell script and have this whole system process it. Actually, the shell script runs some of these other agents, but that's neither here nor there. Or SQL commands we can just run in the background, because the commands to do a lot of different analysis with this much data can sometimes take a while, so you can just run them that way. An agent to determine file type, and we parse spec files like I mentioned before, and then lib extractor. So that's all we have today. I want to just mention the scheduler for a minute, because there is so much processing, like John mentioned. I mean, it takes a lot of the horsepower to analyze all these files for all the different things we're looking for. So we have a scheduler that will spawn these agents on as many hosts as we can grab. Now, the system is a little stupid. I'm not supposed to say that, am I? The reason it's a little stupid is because all of these machines running agents have to cross NFS mount each other. Because there are some agents, none of those that I mentioned, but there are some agents to come that actually need to access files no matter where they are. However, there are a lot of agents, there are a lot of agents that really only need to operate on the host that those files are stored on. Remember that naming scheme? So that naming scheme makes it very easy for us to compute which host a file is going to live on, providing we have a configuration file that tells us, you know, files, you know, 00 to, you know, FF are on this host, and well, that would be everything. Files from 00 to 7F are on this host, and from 80 to FF are on this host. So now we can by having the files distributed, we can calculate easily which host they're on with just a config file. So the scheduler actually will farm out data to process to the right host that has that local data, so that they don't have to mess with NFS traffic. Our agents communicate, our system communicates with the agents. What does that mean? Our agents aren't written for a single use. You know, you don't write an analysis agent that only tries to analyze this particular file, right? You write an analysis agent, and then the scheduler can actually feed it what to analyze. All the communication is done with standard in, standard out. So it doesn't really matter what your agents are written in. I don't know too many agents or too many languages that can't handle standard in, standard out. Another thing that our scheduler does is it implements a hierarchical agent organization. So remember when we uploaded a file, of course we didn't really upload a file, but I showed a picture of what it looks like if you were going to upload a file, and it's going to run that analysis agent. That actually spawns 8 agents, I think. Because the first one has to do the WGET, you know, if it's out there in the net someplace. And then the next one has got to unpack that archive. Well, you don't want to start unpacking until you get the file. So there's a dependency there. So this actually supports multiple, supports dependencies in what runs. This is, look at that. This is the output from, this is kind of old output, but this is output from our scheduler status. You know, if you use the Fossology software, there's this button there that says show what the heck's going on. If you take a look at the mule one on the bottom, oh, no, you can take a look at the ones on the top too, but they're not very interesting. Right off the top of the screen, the part that you can't see, where it tried to, somebody uploaded a trace log. Well, that's interesting, isn't it? But, and you can see there was a, it got unpacked and it took like 33 seconds to unpack it. Then nothing happened. You know, it did the license analysis. Remember the package metadata I was talking about, the spec agent. Nothing happened. Well, the reason nothing happened is because somebody had already uploaded it. So once we took a look at what was there, all the files were already in our repository, so we had nothing to do. So that's why the zero times. But let's take a look at the mule, mule on the bottom. You can see that, does this thing shine very brightly? Is there? But that's okay. You can see mule, when it did the unpack, and you're talking about how much time does this take. This is running on a HP Blade server, just an x86 Blade. When it unpacked emule, it unpacked 1,239 items. It took, you know, 2 minutes and a second. So that's the process of taking that archive and splitting it out into all its individual files. Then we need to do the license analysis step, which is actually these three agents that are dependent on each other. The first one is filter license. And I'm going to explain why this is a pipeline in a bit, because what does this license analysis is really cool. You're going to like it. So you can see the first thing we have to do is we have to pre-process the files to do the license analysis. That's what filter license is. So it only had processed 1,163 items. What's with that? Because we just unpacked 1,239, why is this only looking at 1,163? Anybody know? It's not just that they're already in there, they're duplicates. So there were just that many duplicates, you know, 70 whatever, six duplicates or whatever that is. So we don't have to reprocess them. Oh, by the way, anybody know what the most common duplicate file is in any distribution? File. Ah, no. The most popular file contents is the zero length file. They're all over the place. Anyway, so you can see that this pre-processing step for the license analysis, filter license, had, you know, 1,100 items. It took 31 elapsed seconds and a runtime of 4.5 minutes. Well, that's because we farmed this out to multiple processors, right? So that's why the elapsed time is so much less than the runtime. That's good enough with that. Any questions on that? Ah, look at that. This is the tool. This is what does the license analysis. We call it BSAM, the SAM being for the symbolic alignment matrix. And I'd like to say the B is because ASAM didn't work out so well. But the real reason is just because it was rewritten in C instead of doing a bunch of stuff in shell, so it's kind of binary. And it handles binary files that the other version didn't. But I like the A and the BSAM. Anyway, it's a multifunctional pattern matcher. We use it in license analysis. So this is the this is what you see when you do a license analysis. This, and by the way, these things that I'm putting here, there's nothing special about them. Even the RTFPL was an accident. So these are just all random things. Pulled up this file, you can see it's snmpvars.c, and the whole file would be down here if you could scroll the screen, but I can't push the screen down. On the left is our color-coded, this is what we found for the license. Let me start all over again from the top, okay? Because I think I'm probably confusing you. There are two windows up on the screen. The one on the right that says Python CWI, I overlaid that on top of what you would normally see in a license analysis. The color-coded one is what you would normally see doing a license analysis. What's in that window on the right is our reference license that we matched against, okay? So if you look at the top, you can see that we're looking at snmpvars.c. We found an 86% match with this Python license. And over here, you can see what we matched. The yellow is what we matched. The white space, like the CMUs, we're saying that's not in the license. So what somebody had done is they had taken this and says, you know, and the name of the real license says, you know, Staking Mathematics, et cetera, not to be used. So they replaced all that location with CMU. So that's how they came up with their license. And that's what we're trying to show with our color coding. Okay? Does that make sense? Okay. And that typically is, the 86, if you're doing the math, you might be thinking the 86% doesn't make sense. It looks like we have a bigger match than that. But don't forget, all the asterisks also are non-matching characters. And you notice it doesn't care about things like line length or any of that kind of stuff. In order to use BSAM, remember I was talking about BSAM, not really license analysis. BSAM is just happens to be what we use for license analysis. We can do pattern matching on all kinds of stuff. The BSAM algorithm was actually derived from, man, I got 5 minutes, right? The BSAM, and hey, I've never done this before. Give me a break. The BSAM. BSAM is what we use for, the BSAM actually came from a protein alignment matrix algorithm for matching up different protein sequences. I thought it was a question. If it was just a yawn, I understand. So first thing we do, so we have a generic pattern matching algorithm. So if you're going to have a generic pattern matching algorithm, the first thing you have to do is you have to precede it with something that puts the input in some form that you care about. In our case, it's just a bunch of integers. We tokenize the input. So for licenses, you know, every word is a token, right? So there's a direct match between words and integers. It doesn't even, is that confusing? Okay, crap. Okay, so we could just match the words. If you say, the quick brown fox, and I say the slow brown fox, that's going to come out as a 90% match, right? Okay. The actual algorithm doesn't use words, it uses integers. And the only reason I'm mentioning that is, I should probably not mention that, because it's just a detail. Let's say now we're not looking for licenses. We're looking for code reuse and C files. So let's do our pre-processing step. And let's take something like this function here, and let's tokenize it. And that's what we'll end up with. Okay? Now, I don't care what the variable names are. I don't care what those numbers actually are. All I really want to know is there is some function, and actually we do know the name of the function, but that there is a variable, there's a for loop, there's a for loop that terminates on a condition for an array. So what we're looking at is the syntax of this function. So when we can pattern match C code just based on the syntax, not the absolute values. So we think that's a really good way to find code reuse. And this gets back to the question that was asked earlier, even though some people are doing their email instead of paying attention, but that's okay.
I'm writing notes. Do you want to see them?
Oh. Okay.
It's bad to disparage the people in the audience.
Oh. I will get you out of your rhythm again.
Okay. So can you see how we can use this for code reuse? Okay, moving on.
So can you question the names of the variables? Do you eliminate the names?
Yes, we eliminate the names of the variables. We know that the variable names are different, but the individual names, we don't care about.
Have you thought about
Well, actually, you can do this, and you can use this for papers. You know, for example, I think you're thinking about people who CS students submitting similar code.
Right.
Sure, you could do that. You can actually just use this for papers. Let's say you're submitting a paper to the IEEE whatever, and you could actually use this to figure out similarities between papers. So we talked about C, and now we're talking about papers and stuff. But what if you took the output from OBJ dump? What if you actually took opcodes? Well, guess what? We can do the same thing. So we could actually take a look at binary files and look for similar patterns in opcodes. Okay. So I think you're getting the idea. I just have to remind myself what's next. I think you're getting the idea that this is kind of a multi-use pattern matcher. As long as you can take an input file, do and figure out what's important to you to tokenize it, then feed it to this BSAM engine, which will line up all of the symbols, will line up all of the tokens and find the best path through them. Okay. So the goal of the Fossology project, since I haven't really mentioned it, I thought this would be a good place to end, was on the goal, is to create a public open source software repository. Okay, you notice that public part? With tools, and the tools are some of the stuff that I've been showing you in screenshots, to facilitate analysis and storage and sharing of metadata. That's what we want to do. This isn't an HP thing. This is all open. Today, if you go to fossology.org, you won't find this. But hopefully in a month or two, you will. It's going to be, okay. So now let's get to the point of the talk. Do I have any time left? So the point of the talk is, how can you use this, across distros today, how could this solve problems across multiple distros? So I just started this, report differences between package stated licenses and real license. I focus on licenses because that's what it does today. For the developers, we actually do more than this today. I was going to bring you a comparison of the 2.6 kernel doing code reuse compared to the 2.6 kernel. And I grabbed the wrong file and I don't know where it is, but I was actually going to show you how we can find code reuse inside of something like that, inside the kernel. That's really nice. If you're a driver developer and somebody submits a new driver, the first thing we want to know is, have I seen this before? Is this, about the same thing as this over here? Can we combine them? Do we really need to have two of them? Whatever. So we've actually done that. That's one of the next things we're going to be putting into this. So report violations of distro license rules. More and more distros are coming up with their own rules that you have to use this set of licenses, or if you want OSI compatible licenses, then there's a set here. Plus you have rules, you look at the FSF rules for license, this is compatible with this and so on. This, we've got all the data. We don't have the report, somebody could write the report, but we've got all the data to do it. The future. I mean, this is just off the top of my head. These things don't exist. But you can see from the system, I'm not talking pie in the sky. We can do this. Trademark searches, dependency graphs, vulnerability tracking, differences between distros, localization reports. I don't know what's important, and that's why the help wanted. I'm hoping you guys can help. Help us out, contribute, or at least, give me your thoughts about how this could be used. So that's the last slide. I'm done. I just wanted to finish on the goals, because we're going to put this repository out there, and I think it could find a lot of different uses, but I don't know what they are yet. Questions? Not today, and you can download the code and build your own repository and do whatever you want. For the public repository, I'm not sure how we're going to handle that. I think we're going to ask people to say what. I think we're going to ask people to fill out a form like they did there, and we'll just vet it for a while until we know who you are, and then. So the project is going to control what goes into the public repository. But still, the question comes up with what do you put in there? Do you go all the way upstream? do you grab, does this become a repository of repositories? Do you just grab distro stuff? Do you, you know, what do you put in here? And we're still, you know, figuring that out. Right now, it's easy for us to grab distros because we process a lot of distros. We do QA on them and all that kind of stuff. So it's easy to throw those in. We've got like, you know, we threw in like the top 1,000 from Fresh Meat because those are interesting. We went after the Fedora CVS just to see, you know, what would it take to just grab everything out of there, you know, do the prep, grab all the files, and it's pretty easy. So we're pretty open to what we've put in it, but it is going to be the maintainers who decide what to put in it. That doesn't mean you can't tell the maintainers what you want in it or become a maintainer. Tim?
I was hoping you could pick up any interesting differences between stated licenses and actual licenses.
Differences between stated licenses and actual licenses?
Yeah, I mean, I would imagine searching for thousands of packages there might be some really
Well, there's no correlation between stated licenses and actual licenses. They, as near as I can tell, no, I mean, they're general, and it depends on the project. Some projects are really good. But in general, there are so many more licenses actually in the code than people say. When people list a package license, they usually list one license. But we usually find many more than that. The question comes up is, are they compatible? Is that a problem? So, you know, that's where you just do an analysis on here. We actually save all the licenses and where all the license tokens matched. And that's why we can put up that color-coded matching screen. We have found lots of things. Well, so I you know how I was randomly picking projects here? I picked AbbeyWord just because everybody knows AbbeyWord, and I was just showing people how to use it. And while I'm looking at this, well, the stated license is GPL. Okay, this isn't going to have the ending you think it's going to have. So I started looking at it, and I found the original BSD license, you know, like from 15 years ago or whatever, that has the attribution clause in it. It's not GPL compatible. So I thought, aha, I have found it. I mean, because this is just totally random. This is a sample of one. I found a violation, and I said so, and then I looked closer. And the BSD licenses are in part of the code that don't appear to be used and aren't in a later version. So I don't have examples off the top of my head. That's what I should have said at the start. Okay. Raghavan? What licenses the metadata going to be under? So everything printed that we have been doing is a free documentation license. So I don't know if that would apply to the metadata or not. Is that the right license? No? What? Creative Commons? I don't know.
No
licensing code that has two licenses, has that been an issue? Or? No. Yeah, I mean, one of the things... No, I mean, you can have single files. There are plenty of files that have many, many licenses in them, like a license file, you know, a license.txt. You know, they'll have lots of different licenses in it. It's not a problem unless you use incompatible licenses.
I mean, like a lot of curl code, for example, will say same licenses curl or GPL, pick whichever you want.
Yeah, that is really a pain. We handle some of those. We don't handle all of them. This isn't meant to be authoritative. In other words, you cannot take what, you know, when we say there's an 86% match of something, what does that mean? You know, what we're trying to do is help. We're not a lawyer. You know, the project isn't trying to give legal advice. So if somebody says, you know, this is not such and such a license, and then they repeat the whole license text, what do you think we do with that? You know? It sure looks like a match, but that not really changes the meaning. So you still have to look at these. But we have found that our determinations have been pretty good. I'm sure they could be better.
So can check things on a per-project basis rather than a per-file basis, can? Like, for example,
yes.
The project just got the license in one file. It's not enough to apply that to all files?
So since it's analyzing the files, so let's say you have a project, and let's say it's an RPM build stuff, so you got a spec file. You know, we'll tell you what's in the spec file for the project. Well, we could, we have the data. And we'll tell you, we'll give you a license histogram of everything we actually found. Does that answer?
What if you have a heap of C files, and you don't put the license in the actual C file, mm-hmm. but you've just got the separate copyright file that applies to the whole project, everything you end up targeting?
So we're only looking for licenses, not copyrights.
I think you're saying that, let's say you just have a tarball, and you just include a file that says this is a license for the entire tarball, but you don't actually include the text of the license in the C file.
That's right. We will catch that. So,
just to be sure, if someone were to take one of those C files from that didn't have the license in the C file and reuse it in their own package that has a completely different and incompatible license, will this catch that even though it was never in that file, but it explicitly was mentioned that it's covered by that other license?
Yes. So, you know, if you've done much pattern matching, well, maybe. Probably. Is that a better answer? I'm not going to stand up here and lie to you. I mean, there's always gray areas. If you do pattern matching, the more data that you have, the better you can pattern match. If you're looking for tiny little bits and words that says, this is licensed under the GPL, and that's it. You know, this project is licensed under GPL, change subject. So those are what we call phrases. You notice the first thing in here? So we have a bunch of heuristics that we've built up through the years of, you know, terms that you can look for that probably refer to a license. And so we flag them separately. They're not licenses, but they refer to licenses. Am I finally getting it?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I think he's asking if there's no license in a file and you move it from one project that's under one license to another project under an incompatible license, would you catch that?
No. Once we do the code reuse part, we can start looking for those. But today, we don't do that. We only look at what we see is what we got in the file.
What happens if you find a C file without the license in it?
We don't care.
Okay.